The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Amateur Traveler, episode 217. Today, the Amateur Traveler takes a little departure and looks at being a tour guide, the fun, the joys, and the headaches. Today in the Amateur Traveler. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have two news stories for you, and both of them talk about sleeping comfortably. In the first one, New Zealand Air is announcing cuddle class, basically seats that fold flat and the footrest comes up so that two adults can sleep. Unfortunately, the row has three seats, so you've got to kick out the middle person, but that'll be available in certain rows on their flights. I, for one, am looking forward to it, except when do you ever see a plane these days that has one seat empty? And the second one, a hotel in England has announced that they're going to have a service where someone can warm your bed up for you. Wearing special all-in-one sleeper suits, they will come and roll around under the covers of your bed until the temperature of the bed is approximately 20 to 24 degrees Celsius. Now, doesn't that sound like a good idea? We talk about both of those stories in more detail on this week's This Week in Travel. Check that out at thisweekintravel.com. And stay tuned to the end of the show. I do have a free offer for you of an ebook on how to book travel online, and I'll tell you more about how you can get that at the end of the interview. I'd like to welcome back to the show Madeline Jawar, who had come on the show previously and talked about traveling to Sicily. And we've got a little different conversation today. Welcome back, Madeline.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be back.
And I should say, Madeline pitched me a show, and that's how a lot of the shows happen these days, is people have an idea for the show, and they try it out to see if they can get me interested, and at least half the time, I turn them down. It's kind of where we are right now. But Madeline pitched the idea of how to be a tour guide, and tell us a little bit about why this turned into a podcast. I think this started out as a blog post.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions from people about how they could work in Italy, since I've worked in Italy in several different jobs. And one of the most fun things I've done in Italy was being a tour guide. And so I realized that a lot of people could be tour guides and don't really realize that they have the skills. And so I decided to write a blog post about, here's why you too could be a tour guide. And I wrote the outline for it, and I was happy with the outline, and I started writing it, and it was just going to be really long. And I just thought, this is too long and too detailed, and nobody's going to want to read it. It's going to be boring. And so I just thought it would work. As I was writing it, I just thought this would just work so much better as a podcast.
Well, and one of the reasons that I was interested, as I was telling Madeline before we started recording, is as I transition away from my day job, which is VP of engineering for a high-tech company, into the Amateur Traveler as a job, and that transition is this week. Friday is my last day at the day job.
Congratulations.
Yeah. You have that excitement. I have excitement and panic at the same time. Yeah. One of the things we've talked about is trips, and we're talking about the trip to Vietnam here in March, but I won't be the tour guide for that. We'll get somebody who actually has been to Vietnam for that. But when we start talking about domestic locations or whatever, then I start to think about, is this something that I could do? And what does it mean to be a tour guide? And what is that all about? And so this seemed like a perfect opportunity to talk about that profession and to talk about how one gets into that. So how did you get into it? First of all, what's your background? You didn't wake up one morning and you were a tour guide.
Actually, that is interesting because I approached it with the same misunderstanding as the people that usually come to me or comment about the fact that I was a tour guide. I started in university as an art history major, decided to switch to a linguistics major, but meanwhile was guiding tours at the art gallery, which happened to be on campus where I went to university. And I ended up being a tour guide in that art gallery for 3 years. And it was hour-long tours about art, which is completely different from guiding a group of 25 people through Italy for a week on a bike, or hiking, which is what I'm doing.
On a bike? I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, I did biking and hiking.
Okay.
So completely different. I would say the overlap is that you have to have some presentation skills, but the presentation skills are obviously key when you're guiding an art gallery tour, and they're kind of important, but they're not going to make or break you as a tour leader for a week-long vacation. Other people's vacation, not your vacation.
Now, I would think an art history background, though, going to someplace like Italy would also be at least not necessary, but certainly useful.
Yes, it was very useful. I didn't even do a year. I did half a year of art history, and then I switched to linguistics. So I can't really say I have an art history background, but I have an interest in art history, and so that's kept up. But what was a very useful skill was being able to assimilate information really fast.
Got it.
Paintings in the art gallery would change all the time, and you had to know who painted it, when, what was the technique, and all that. And then you had to present that to a group of people. And that skill of learning new information quickly and then being able to teach it to other people, that was very useful when I then became a tour guide in Italy. But it's a completely different kind of tour guide. And from the art gallery, I actually moved to then being another type of leading hour-long guided tours in the same place where I went to university, and it was a historical fort that was in the town where I was called Fort Henry, which is in Canada. And I played the role of a soldier's wife, and I gave 90-minute tours to tourists. Well, I actually gave the tours in English, French, and I had to give them in German, which I'm a bit embarrassed to say because I don't speak German very well, but I don't want anyone to be under the impression I speak German. And then whenever there were Italian tourists that came to the site, they would call me and I would give the Italian tour. So from there, I thought, I'm a tour guide. I'm going to go be a tour guide in Europe. That would be fun. Not realizing that it was pretty much a completely different job.
Now, when you say it's different, and I'm guessing here, and I'm curious to see how close I am, to me, a tour guide in Europe, there's a lot of logistics involved.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You are a project manager.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, a person who has a background, as I did, guiding people through art galleries or whatever on short tours is maybe fine. But somebody with a project management background, or somebody who can juggle lots of balls in the air, or somebody who's really good at running events, that's something that will make you very successful.
The two things that I think about in that range that I'm not sure I want to do, frankly, are dealing with the unexpected, which is one of the reasons you're really working on that tour. You're not vacation yourself. And then also dealing with whiny people.
Well, and that's another, I would say, so the logistics is really important. You have to be very good at, running the project. And then you also have to be, a good people person. And there are a few different types of people person that work. There's not just one type that works. You could be the sort of, hey, everything's great, don't worry about it. You could be that. And that the kind of person that walks into a networking event and just works the room, that type of person. Everything's going fine, don't worry. You want to make your 25 people or whoever you've got on your tour feel like everything's under control, everything's going smoothly, even when there may be a little glitch here and there and you just want to handle it and take care of it, not let any of the travelers know about it because they don't need to worry about it, especially if you're taking care of it. So that type of person works. And then also the second type is more who I am, is I'm not very good at networking events. I don't really enjoy going into a big room and meeting 100 people in 30 minutes. But I do really enjoy talking to people one-on-one and finding out who are your kids, what do you do for a living, why are you here, why did you choose this trip? And that's just as effective in terms of being a tour guide. But in both sets of people skills, you have to put up with the whining. And you have to not only put up with it, but you have to, as in customer service, you're the face of the company. So you have to say, I hear you. I acknowledge what you're saying. Let me take steps to address your issue and let me get back to you. And then you actually have to do all of that, and get back to them. Even if you're rolling your eyes and thinking, everybody got a lumpy bed last night. It's just the hotel that we were in, and I'm really sorry. Or whatever the issue is. I mean, you have to take it seriously.
Right. Well, and I told the story on the show before, but I think of the bus tour I did in Costa Rica where we went to a rainforest, and some people were very disgruntled because it rained.
Yeah.
And of course, it rains 350 inches a year. So the odds that you would go there and it wouldn't rain when you were there are actually pretty small. So there are the expectation issues that you also run into on, I would think, any group or a large group, especially if you don't have a relationship with the people. And heck, when I'm traveling with my family, sometimes they whine too much for me. So,
yeah, expectations are key.
With your switching over there, and you think you know what you're getting into, when did you know you didn't? And what was the moment you thought, uh-oh, this is not what I thought?
In the interview.
Okay.
I applied for a job, a company who a friend of mine was doing, and they did bus tours. And I think it was probably fate. I wrote the date of the interview on the wrong date. And so I showed up a day late for my interview. And so that obviously didn't work. But then I started researching the industry and thinking, well, this sounds like a really fun job. And then I applied to work for Butterfield and Robinson, who did the hiking and the biking tours. And during the interview, they said to me, you need to be able to drive a stick shift. And you need to be a basic bike mechanic. And I nodded and smiled. And I didn't say that I could do it, but I had driven a stick shift forklift in a previous summer job where I worked in a recycling plant. I could honestly say that I had driven a stick shift. I said I would take a bike course before being hired. And I did that. But there were some details that sort of piled up where I thought, oh boy, this is a lot different from playing the role of a soldier's wife and describing 19th century Canada for an hour and a half. But I was also really excited. I mean, I had just graduated from university. I wanted to go travel and see the world, and I was going to be paid for it. So I was sort of nervous and excited, probably a little bit like you're feeling right now, right?
Possibly a little less panic because you didn't have two kids in college and a mortgage, but yeah.
I was homeless. So that also worked out really well.
I believe that term is now location independent.
Oh, okay. Yes, I was done with university. Yeah, I was location independent. I had no rent to pay, put my stuff in storage, brought a big backpack over to Europe, which I then lived out of for 9 months during the season, and then basically threw the stuff away at the end because I was so tired of wearing it. And then did the same thing for the next season. The seasons with the biking and hiking tours, there's a season in the spring and a season in the fall, and then you don't do it in the winter and you don't do it in the summer because of the weather. And because I did it.
Okay.
I did one trip in Germany, but I did mostly Italy.
It's just too hot in the summer, though.
Yeah, you're not going to be cycling in Italy in August or December. So.
Okay. And as you think about that, and we're talking about the range of things, what is kind of the best day and what is the worst day? How does the problem bound here?
The best day for a tour guide?
Yeah.
The best days are, so I think it starts in the morning when everybody's expectations are accurately set, and that's huge. The goal of breakfast, I would get up early and fix bikes, and so I'd be up for an hour before everybody else, and I'd be adjusting brakes and pumping tires and whatever they need, whatever the complaints were from the year before, and so I'd, or the day before. So I'd arrive at breakfast. And my only goal was to set expectations. And as you can imagine, for cycling trips, there's one expectation, and that is, where are the hills? So
people want to know. Yes, that would be me. Okay.
They want to know, where are the hills? How many are there? And how long are they? And if you forget about a hill, that's bad because people pace themselves. And we would cycle for, I mean, depending on, some trips were harder than others or longer than others, but we would be on the bike 6 hours a day, maybe, or probably six. So we'd leave breakfast and we'd cycle for an hour and a half, and then we'd have an event, and then we'd do an hour, and then we'd have lunch, and then we'd do 2 hours, and then we maybe had an event, and then we'd had an hour and go back to the hotel. So if there was a big hill in there somewhere, let's say the afternoon event was a wine tasting. Well, people said, well, oh, Madeline said that the hardest hills were over after lunch, and then they do wine tasting and they're kind of barely able to cycle back to the hotel, and then they hit a big hill. Then I'd hear about it at dinner. So that was really important. And that's just something that you just had to know the route. I mean, the more times I did a trip, the better I knew the route, the easier that was. If I get that right, that's huge. Then the second thing that makes things flow smoothly, which then translates to a good day for me, is just if all the travelers are accounted for. And so
and not losing them. That's really way up there on the priority list, as far as I understand it.
Well, you know, these are independent tours, and so people they're reading their route instructions. They're reading cycle 1 mile and then take a left at the yellow farmhouse, and lots of people get lost. I'm not saying half the trip gets lost every day, but on every trip I guided, at some point somebody got lost, and so you need to be on top of that. You need to know. And they're usually between 20 and 25 people on these trips. And so you need to just be sweeping the route. There are two guides on these trips, I should say. Mm-hmm. So one guide is on a bike and one guide is in the van. And if you're in the van, your job is to not only transfer the luggage, which hopefully you do right away, first thing in the morning, and you get back on the route and you sweep the route with the van. And you need to know where everybody is. And so if there's anybody that's tired or needs water, you need to address that. But you need to make sure that you counted 24 travelers or whoever. And one time we actually had, there's an abbey in Tuscany that has two entrances. And so we actually had a group of eight. They were pretty obvious when they went missing, a third of the group. But they went into the abbey in one road, and they actually came out on, the abbey was at the top of a hill. And they went out on the other side and went down this long, long, long hill and into a different valley. And then none of the rune instructions made sense, of course. And so I had gotten back to the hotel and they weren't there. And I took the van and basically was driving around the hills of Tuscany trying to find them. And I found them and I piled them into the van and threw their bikes in the van and drove them back to the hotel. And that just adds a level of stress when that happens. So if everybody's obviously accounted for and having fun, because you're checking in on people and they're having fun and they've got water and they've got snacks, they bought some olive oil and you showed up in time to put the olive oil in the van so they're not carrying it on their bike. And then also, if the meals in Italy are really important, the meals and the events are really important. You want the meals to be balanced. You don't want to have a huge lunch and a huge dinner in the same day. And of course, as guides, we would have 3 days beforehand to meet with all the restaurateurs and everybody who was going to be providing the food. And they all want to do, let's say you're cycling in Tuscany in October. Well, everybody wants to put truffles on the menu. And so, you know, you don't, everybody wants to put on the menu whatever's the local specialty because they can do it best.
Right, right.
The food in Italy is very seasonal. So whatever is in season is what everybody's eating. But you don't want to do an 8-day trip where you're eating truffles as good as they are for lunch and for dinner. So you just had to make sure that there was balance with the meals. And if there wasn't, then people notice and it's not ideal. And then it's important that the events run smoothly. So you have a wine tasting. You want to make sure that everybody shows up for the wine tasting on time, that the wine tasting starts with all 25 travelers present, that everybody participates and can hear. We had Burton Anderson speak a few times, like lead wine tastings a few times, and they're significant events, and you want to make sure that every single traveler has a good experience with those. Often at dinner, you hear about the day, and so they start drinking wine, and people will say, oh, yeah, I didn't hear anything at the wine tasting. That's when you hear about it. To wrap up the good day of a tour guide, if you don't hear too many complaints at dinner once the wine gets flowing, then it's been a good day.
What was the biggest surprise as you became a tour guide? After you'd been through the interview and you had a little better idea, what still surprised you?
How much work it was. It was a lot of work.
Okay.
I mean, I literally did not write a postcard to my family. It was 6 a.m. to, I would say, midnight or 1 a.m. during the trip for 7 or 8 days in a row. And that was after you'd done 2 or 3 days of pre-trip stuff at breakneck speed, because if you're doing a hiking trip, you're actually jogging the hiking trails. You have to learn the routes. And so, yeah, so if you're doing the bike trip, then you're driving the routes, but you're also confirming hotels and you're learning the layout of hotels, and you need to kind of have the rooms in your head so that if you give the Smiths a sea view one day, then the Joneses get the sea view in the next hotel. There's a lot to learn in the pre-trip, and so that's kind of breakneck speed. And then the trip is obviously 8 days of just sheer hard work. And then there was one day to do expenses, and which was good. But Butterfield & Robbins has their office in France, which is probably a 10-ish, 12-ish, depending on where you're leaving from in Italy, hour drive. So you're dropping off the trip, you're saying goodbye to people, and then you're getting in the van and taking 26 bikes back to France. So you have that 10-hour drive. And I actually really enjoyed that. I mean, that was total downtime for me. And you're driving through the Alps, and it's spectacular. I mean, you're driving through, I would always drive through the Mont Blanc tunnel. But then literally, I would have a day to do my accounting and then turn around and do another trip. In high, well, all seasons were high seasons, but I would do 6 trips back to back. Bring the bikes back, pick up more bikes, and head back down to Italy. So it was just, it was a lot of work, but fun work.
And why'd you quit?
I got hired by one of my clients.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I was, who's still a very good friend. And just coincidentally, she was doing a trip with me in Tuscany and had signed up for a Cinque Terre hiking trip right after that. Her husband was a pastor, and she described herself as a pastor's wife. And so I just clicked with them and got to know them. And at the end of the trip, she said, if you ever want to come and work for me, I would love to have you. And I said, well, what do you do? And she was essentially the COO of a $8 billion company. So I finished guiding and I had my fun. And I think I probably guided 6 more trips after that. And then I called her and I said, what would the job entail? And I did international operations, basically. So, and I worked for her for 8 years.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
One warning you would give to somebody who's thinking about this as a career, even if a temporary career, as it was for you?
I guess things will go wrong. I had a client get hit by a car.
Oh, my.
Yeah. I made some mistakes. On my first trip, I got a big group of travelers completely lost, which was completely my own fault. And so I had to deal with that. It was in Germany, and there was 2 mountains, and each mountain had a castle on top of it. And I read the map wrong and took them up the wrong mountain. So that was hard to come out of, because then we had to go back down the mountain and back up the other mountain. And it was like 45 minutes of tough cycling up each mountain. And they were annoyed, to say, understandably. But that was my first trip, and I learned a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, it's hard work, and you just have to go with the flow. I guess the one thing I haven't mentioned that are probably the most important qualities, we talked about people skills, we talked about project management skills. I would say, and for anybody considering doing this job, I would say you do need the language.
Okay.
So if you're thinking, boy, you know, this sounds fun, what a great thing to do, I would say people skills, project management skills, and if, I'm talking about Italian, but obviously it could be any country, but you need to be able to function in the country. You need to be able to kind of do a basic level of business without misunderstandings and without struggling. And so those are really the things that I tell people. If you have those 3 things and you're interested in something like this, consider it, because anybody can learn to be a bike mechanic. Anybody can learn to drive a stick shift. You don't need to be in fantastic physical shape just because you're cycling 6 hours a day. I mean, you need to be in good shape, but you don't need to be a Tour de France contender for the trips that I did, obviously. So I was going to send you a link. There was an article in one of the British newspapers, I want to say The Independent recently, that I can send you a link that had a list of all the tour companies.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Butterfield and Robinson was not in the list, but it just goes to show that there are so many to choose from. And so I only applied to one because that's the one that I knew about. But there's many, many, many that people could apply to.
And then I also know that there are some places you can go to get trained as a tour guide. I know there's a school here in San Francisco that's well known that I'm hoping to do an article about when I get a chance to go up there and interview them. So I have a usual question that I ask, but I'm going to a little bit of a different spin. You really know you're a tour guide when what?
Oh, gosh. You know your tour. When people ask you questions all the time and they act like you are in charge. And when the buck stops here.
Mm-hmm.
Really, you're the face of the company and they don't care that there's head office. Their problem is in front of you now and you need to solve it. You don't get to say, well, so-and-so, when they organized this trip, they didn't think about dessert. The buck stops with you, and so you need to use your people skills and your logistics skills and fix it. And I should also say, you know, I met such amazing people on these trips. I mean, this is just the most interesting people with very high expectations. I mean, I had a lot of CEOs and chairmen of big companies that I then when I went to work in corporate America, then I knew who they were, but I didn't at the time. I had no idea. And so it was amazing for networking.
Interesting.
The contacts I made were incredible.
Okay. And if you had to summarize being a tour guide in three words, what three words?
Hard work. Is that two words? So
I'll give you that as a hyphenated word.
Okay, that'll be a hyphenated word. So hard work, ton of fun. There's another hyphenated word. and worthwhile. I mean, I just learned so much. And that's why I wanted to write the blog and do this podcast, is because I feel like I'm telling people all the time. People want to go explore Europe, and there are plenty of people who like to work hard. And I just saw so much of Italy and just got to know what all the best things were in every region at the time that they were the best. So you just get to see so much and do so much that you, A, probably might not be able to afford on your own if you were just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And B, you might not even be able to find, because the trips are created with a lot of research and thought and people with experience. And so they show you things that you may not have even uncovered.
Interesting.
So that's just a huge, huge bonus, huge plus. And you get tips at the end. I used to get paid and then double that in tips.
Hmm.
I mean, get the same amount in tips.
Sure, so. Rand. Madeline, thanks so much for coming back on the show. I know that your interview with you about Sicily has certainly put that way up on my list of places to go, so it was fun to have you back on the show talking about being a tour guide.
Oh, thank you. Well, thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate having the opportunity to come back.
I had one internet resource for you, and that's an article that came out recently on toptravelsites.com. That's the top 100 travel blogs. And they're ranking people based on Alexa and Compete.com. And I'm not sure if you're aware of those services, but they allow you to estimate a site's traffic. And they differ very much in terms of what the actual site traffic is. I know in the Amateur Traveler, Compete thinks I have half as much traffic as Alexa does for some particular reason. But it's interesting to see who's in that list. The Amateur Traveler did make that list in the top 50. It ranked a little low because it ranked for the last month, and I was in Europe for part of that month. So I'm interested to see what that's going to do next month, but you might want to check out that list. There's some fine sites in that list. In News of the Community, I had a comment made on last week's post on travel to Malawi that pointed out those Chinese characters that we were mentioning on that pink bus in the episode are actually Japanese characters. So Kazu has some sharp eyes there and caught what I missed. Max left a comment on the travel photography episode, says, I just listened to the podcast with Ralph Velasco on travel photography. It was a very enjoyable discussion that I think anyone who likes to take pictures can benefit from. I consider myself a good landscape photographer, but I am also one who usually looks away from any people who might, quote, spoil the picture. The idea about including an element to provide understandable scale to the image and some human touch was excellent. And I should point out that Ralph and I are actually talking tomorrow about a river cruise on the Rhine River in Europe, obviously, in September. That would be a joint cruise between his travel photography and the Amateur Traveler. And so it would involve some photography lessons on the cruise. Let me know if you're interested, and we'll certainly get some information about that as soon as we have it. But you might want to circle September on your calendar. And then lastly, as we wind this show down, I did promise you a free ebook. So I've written an ebook on how to book travel online, how to save money while you book travel online. It's especially good for people who are beginners to intermediates in terms of booking travel online. It tells you about different types of sites, like aggregation sites versus discount sites, and then goes into how you would use those different sites in a strategy to save money on your travel. So check that out. To get that free ebook, you need to join the mailing list. And I wrote it to try and get you to join the mailing list, because I found, especially when I was trying to do the Vietnam tour, for instance, that I had trouble getting a hold of people, because I know many of you are a month behind or even more with listening to the show. And so the weekly email will give me a better chance to keep you up to date on new information. With that, we're going to bring this show to a close. Feel free to drop me an email at host@amateurtraveler.com. Leave a comment at amateurtraveler.com on this episode, as we heard a couple people do in this episode. Or follow me on Twitter at Chris2X for everything, or Amateur Traveler just for the Amateur Traveler news. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be